From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter, and joining me in the Rocky Mountain High is Cramps fan, Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And joining us from his Tibetan monastery, we have Mr. Stuart Balk, learning the dark arts. Say hello, Stu.
Yeah, hello. I feel like I need about 1,500 years sleep as well.
Exhausted. And his connection in the Cecil Hotel is no better than it was last time, Mr. Eric Zalber.
Tally ho, Governor. Yeah.
So
this is Eric's last chance on audio only before you can get the fuck right out.
All right.
So this week we're doing License to Kill. And one of the second and final James Bond film for Timothy Dalton, but it's the first with Sanchez.
And for some of us, the final James Bond movie.
Mm-hmm. This is one that, was this the first one to not have an Ian Fleming title?
Yes.
Yep.
And,
unless you don't want to count Never Say Never Again.
Yeah, I don't count that one because it's not a broccoli Eon.
Yeah, it shouldn't count.
It's not official.
Ever. Right?
Never.
Never.
Never count it. Ever.
Never count it again.
Never say McQuarrie again.
Never say canonical.
Never say this film's title again, it should be called.
But License to Kill to me was always like the 80s action James Bond movie. Mm-hmm. It was the one that felt most influenced by the tropes of the day, more so than License to Kill, more so than any of the more ones. That one feels like an 80s action movie. In fact, when I was watching it, the opening scene and act, I was like, this feels more like Miami Vice than James Bond. Like,
it feels like a canon movie.
Yeah, the plot is more like Wise Guy. Ken Wall show.
But it's like cheap looking. It just feels like a canon film.
Well, I was watching it going, James Bond's hair's not combed. He's hanging out like with Big Ed from Twin Peaks.
Well, before we better do our junk section before we get into
Yeah.
Skip it through.
Yeah. Sorry. Whip out your junk. Yes. All right. Stu, you want to go first?
License to Kill. Yeah, I can do that. I actually got it with me this time. Just three items this week. First up, I've got vinyl. Holy shit. Mm. Look at that. 7-inch Lunar Chicks.
Mm.
The cookie. It's called Cookie Monster. It's actually Cookie Core backed with complication from fucking sides, which one? Yeah, it's about the same. That there's Cookie Core backed with complication off their first album, Babysitters on Acid. But it's not easy to find and comes with everything. With a little cookie in there and the poster. Very cool. So that's added to the big Lunatics collection that I have. Along with this. Didn't know this was out until couple of weeks back and bought it straight away. Fallopian Rhapsody, the book, the story of the Lunar Chicks. very cool. There's no dirty pictures this time. There's Theo, Gina, and Sydney in their high school days. Haven't read it all, read some. Very cool. Can't wait to finish it off. And finally, got this in yesterday. This was a band I found on YouTube, mind you. Never heard of them. Just crawling around through the new section of YouTube, even though this album is 5 years old. One album, and they're actually disbanded. What a shame. A band, power metal band from Greece called Angel Mora.
Huh.
This is a damn fine album. What a damn shame this band's gone.
Angel Mora?
Angel Mora. The album's all in English, so they're not. It's not saying in Greek or anything. Got this from a Greek dealer, actually, for about $20 delivered to Australia. And that was brand new, still sealed. The band is, gone because the lead singer's moved from Greece to London and they've split. So they're a one album effort. But I tell you what, if you can get your hands on it, they're on Spotify if you want to hear the album. The album's called Mask of Treason. But Angel Mora, damn good album. Highly recommend it. That's it for me. That's all I got this week.
All right, John, you want to go next?
Yeah, I got this Blu-ray from Finland. This is Super Snooper, better known in America as Super Fuzz.
Yeah!
Darren Thill movie. It's a really nice looking Blu-ray. Best I've ever seen this film look. Unfortunately, it's not the American Avco Embassy Super Fuzz cut, which is a bit tighter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Buddy Goes West, a Bud Spencer spaghetti western. Bit of a disappointment. I watched this one. It's got a good Ennio Morricone score, but yeah, great I can't really recommend it, though. It's a weaker Bud Spencer movie. You're better off getting Banana Joe. And even Angels Eat Beans with Bud Spencer and Giuliano Gemma. And I have not watched this yet. This is, I think, the last one I got to watch in the set that I ordered. And looking forward to that. It's got a good reputation. And that's it for me.
All right.
So for me, Hammer movie, Night Creatures. With
Kevin Clegg.
Yeah, with Peter Cushing. Looks like a lot of fun. It's one I've never seen.
It's a good one.
I got The Hunchback of Notre Dame with Lon Chaney.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Who's that released by?
This is Kino Lorber.
Oh, okay. Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Does it come with that opening? That's usually opening? Missing?
That's usually I don't know. I just got it. I haven't had the chance to look at it yet. Let's see.
Outside of Invisible Man, it's probably my favorite Universal monster. It's not even part of their cycle, really.
Yeah, this is a really good one. I'm looking forward to watching it on Blu-ray. And speaking of Hunchback, I've been doing some kind of nesting with classic Disney stuff to watch with my daughter when she gets here later on. And I got the Hunchback Disney movie, which I absolutely love. I think it's a great movie. I don't know if any of y'all have seen it.
I saw it in the theater at the time.
It's fantastic. Pinto from Animal House plays the Hunchback. And Jason Alexander's in it, but it's actually, as far as Disney animated movies, it's pretty, I mean, it doesn't go as dark as the book, but it's pretty heavy as far as
in the book. Frollo is a clergyman, right?
Yeah, in this he's a politician.
He's a judge. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, the clergyman is a good guy in this one. But the songs are great. Like there's the opening track is great, like the Hellfire song. It's a really good film. And speaking of Disney,
somehow squeaked by with a G rating.
Yeah. The House of Mouse has some pull in Hollywood. Speaking of mice, great Mouse Detective.
You know, sadly, I rewatched that recently and it just, you know, I'm an adult now, but it probably has more to do with it than anything, but it just doesn't hold up. I used to love that movie as a kid.
Yeah. When I saw it several times in the theater when I was a kid. Probably is the reason I like Sherlock Holmes, to be honest.
Well, probably. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that.
You know, this was made when Disney was kind of early Renaissance,
it's pre-Renaissance. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But, this one I'm very excited about. This TV show is one of my favorite things on right now. All season two of All Creatures Great and Small.
Ah.
Boy, yeah. You're really buying up before that kid comes, aren't you?
Yes, sir. All
Did you get the books?
Yeah, and my wife has them all. She's been to James Herriot's house twice. And she turned me on to it. And when this new series came out, we picked it up. And the first season's fantastic. And Diana Rigg was in it before she passed away. And she played Tricky Woo's mom.
Wears a cat suit.
No. But I watched the first episode of season two, and so far it's excellent. It's a great show. There's none of the like just absolute idiotic nonsense that just infects everything. It's a very straightforward, wholesome show. So very good. That's it.
You ever see the SCTV sketch? Bless the wee-legged beasties.
No.
It spoofed the 70s British, you know, TV version of that, of those stories. It's pretty good. They just bring animals in. He goes, gotta put them to sleep. Cause I mean, if you read the stories, he pretty much kills every animal at the end of the story anyway. So he doesn't save any of them. It's sad. It's a very, very rough read.
Yeah. I don't see why anyone would want to be a veterinarian. You know,
you gotta put them to sleep. Yeah. Dave Thomas played. It was pretty funny. I'll have to link. I'll link that in the group and put no explanation for it. Anybody knows what we're talking about?
Yeah, do it.
Like, I want to put some John Romano videos in the group so people would actually understand the impression I did on the last show for Batman. But picking out the right clip is always tough.
The thing is, there's so many good ones that it's hard to pick one.
I gotta have him saying, "Show me the bodies" when asked about steroids, and you know, he's got
the one you want to go for, John's the 2021. I think he did. Was you'll probably get a few nuggets out of that.
Yeah,
steroids.
He's because he's been doing show me the bodies for like 20 years. He's been doing that since Bigger, Faster, Stronger. And that I think it was a John Stossel interview or one of those shows, but yeah, great stuff.
That podcast he used to do with Dave Palumbo, the Heavy Muscle Radio. Holy shit, that was one of the funniest things out there. You wouldn't think a bodybuilding podcast would be funny, but that thing used to tear me up. It was that funny. Absolute pisser it was. Yeah.
Well, Eric, is there anything you want to share? You don't have video, so it's like
no. You can describe it to us.
I'm hard pressed to, I got, I technically don't have it yet. Tomorrow it's coming in. I got, kind of a holy grail for me. It's very tough to find. It's the Pan Books version of the Green Ripper, one of the later Travis McGee novels. And the cover is a woman in scuba gear who's got the scuba gear kind of zipped down to her midriff. So you see her giant tatas and a little bit anyway. And it was hard to find for a little while. And I saw it for nothing on eBay and I snapped it up.
Sounds like a Hideo Kojima game character design.
it looks very close to that. Yeah.
Yeah. The American cover is just like a wrapped statue and a machine gun, like no chicks.
I just assumed that was part of the cult. I've never read the book. I'm aware of what happens in the book. Looking forward to it. It kind of divides fans a little bit. Like there's people who absolutely love it and count it as their best one. And there's those that absolutely hate it. So I'm probably going to end up falling in the middle as I usually do with that kind of divisiveness.
But it is true. Like the people who love it, it's their favorite of the whole series.
Yeah.
And the people who hate it just despise it. So
he's like Mac Bolan or something.
Yeah, yeah. So Trav goes Mac Bolan. turns into the Punisher.
Speaking of Mac Bolan, License to Kill.
Mm. Yeah.
It is like a canon movie. Like in this movie, James Bond he's getting revenge, you know? He's just killing. And he's like Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest, you know, working the guys against each other, you know, to get them to kill each other off.
With his receding hairline.
Yeah, I was thinking Dalton looked kind of rough in this movie. Did anybody ever
else? The hair is bad. He had great hair as far as I remember for the first one. This time, I don't know. I don't know if they cared. If he went on to do more, which God, I wish he did.
Yeah,
they would have had to give him a piece. Yeah, they would have gotten to give him a piece, I guess, because by 1995, whenever Goldfinger came, Goldmember.
Oh my God.
GoldenEye came out. He would have probably been worse off than he was in 89. So, in terms of hair.
Eric, you know what saved Timothy Dalton this film, though, from looking rough? Robert Darby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they got the absolute.
Oh, what I mean, you think I look rough? What about this guy over here?
Yeah. That might have been a strategy that they had, actually.
Yeah. No. In the interviews with Robert Darby, you know, me and Mickey Rourke, you know, and these other actors, we'd go into the bars around town and mix it up, you know, and Dalton and I were going back to the Fleming novels, and you know, the bad guy should be the mirror image of James Bond. Everybody who plays a Bond villain says
that.
Like it's some massive revelation. Nobody's thought of it before.
Yeah.
And oftentimes in the books, with the exception of Blofeld, they're not the mirror image of Bond. So no. I don't know what the hell are you talking about?
No, I mean, he's just...
they're like George Soros-style geeks, you know?
Yeah,
exactly right. They're Bill Gates, basically.
Yeah. Well,
this guy was kind of like Tony Montana or something.
Actually, Doctor No's way smarter than Bill Gates. Bill Gates is a fucking phony.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
but Doctor No didn't have man boobs.
Yeah, in a pink sweater.
I can imagine. How much you want to bet though? Like Robert Davi was hanging out with like AJ Benza in the 90s.
Oh yeah. Oh, you know he was
going to the Playboy Mansion with Mickey Rourke.
Those poor bunnies.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
And then you have Anthony Zerbe in this movie, who's like, he's got that mustache.
Yeah,
like got these killer. He's like, I don't like it. I don't like him. He can finger me. These lines where you're like, okay. But and speaking of
wait,
like,
wait. Oh, hang on a second. His lines, he would have read them and said, "This is still better than Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park."
Yes,
line.
Oh, yeah, that's true. After Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, everything Anthony Zerbe did seemed like Shakespeare. You know. Oh man!
All the squawking,
and he has like a really '80s gore death. Is this the goriest James Bond movie?
Yeah. I think to this day, yeah.
Anthony Zerbe gets put in a pressure chamber and his head explodes like in Scanners.
Yep.
Up until the 2007 release of on DVD, you couldn't see the full cut. It was cut by a few frames just before the head exploded, at least in America.
And Benicio del Toro, a very young Benicio del Toro.
Oh shit. Yeah.
He looks like a kid. Plays one of the henchmen, and his death scene, he gets like shoved into a meat grinder and you see it, like he explodes. Yeah.
There's a few frames that were added to that too.
Yeah, I was like, holy crap, when I was watching this. Like, you know, my wife would be in the room and she was like, oh my gosh, his head's gonna explode. I was like, it's James Bond, they're not gonna show it. And then
Well, I remember he was the implied rapist in ruining Felix Leiter's honeymoon. He goes, don't worry, we give her a good honeymoon.
We give her a nice honeymoon.
Yeah.
What was it? But one reason I didn't remember how gory it was because I only ever saw this movie on TBS.
So. Oh, that explains it.
Yeah, so that's one reason I was like, dang, I was watching this.
Isn't there a guy that gets impaled by a what do they call a caterpillar or something? Towards the end when the lab is blowing up, there's a guy who's impaled by a forklift. That's what it is.
Okay.
A forklift. You don't remember that?
I'm trying to remember. It's not ringing a bell, but I'm sure there's a lot going on.
It's not as salacious as the other stuff, but
apparently this place already existed. They didn't build it for the movie, but it's like Epcot Center Aztec Land, you know, where the finale takes place. You It feels like a Disney ride or something. But I liked that because it felt like the old Ken Adams sets, which were always very kind of over the top and showy, you know. But one thing, so something about this film is I think sometimes James Bond chases stuff in the culture. And I think Bond is always best when Bond is just being Bond, you know?
Right.
But this one, it felt like a lot of action trends at the time. Like, you know, it felt like, you know, Miami Vice, some of these other shows we were talking about. But
a Joel Silver movie.
Yeah, a Joel Silver movie.
Even uses Davi and what's his name? Grandel Bush or whatever his name is, the black actor.
It even has a score by Michael Kamen.
Yep.
And I was thinking, Michael Kamen is not a guy I want doing a Bond score. You know,
right.
He's an 80s action composer, but, you know, I was missing that John Barry music.
Michael Kamen was everywhere at that time.
Yeah, he was.
Independent movie was scored by Michael Kamen. So
it
was just brought back Bill Conti. Everywhere.
Yeah, Bill. Hey, I liked Bill Conti's score.
It's really good.
On what was it?
For Your Eyes Only.
Your Eyes Only, yeah.
I thought he was a good fit. I don't think Michael Kamen's a good fit, but
gave it a good European feel too.
Yes.
It's probably one of the last Bond movies that even felt European.
Yeah, no, I agree. But you know, the License to Kill being an 80s action movie, I like that kind of stuff, so it doesn't bother me too much. But I was thinking, you know, and I'm sure, and I know you guys are all going to agree with me on this, an example of this, like, really being kind of pervasive is the Craig Bond films. I think those were very Nolanified, very like lorified, you know, Marvel, like we have to build lore and build a bigger world. And, you know, we got to get, who is James Bond, you know, like what happened to his parents, you know? And I don't think that did those movies any favors. And the Craig films were best when they were being more Bondish. You know?
Did that trend start with, because the first thing that comes to mind is it started right out of the gate with Moore, because his first movie was a blaxploitation thing. The second one was a kung fu thing. And then Spy Who Loved Me, I guess, was its own thing. But but certainly Moonraker, Star Wars, obviously. Yeah. But did it start with Sean Connery? I'm trying to think. Diamonds doesn't really try to chase after anything.
No. I don't know, John. You might be able to speak to that a little more with Connery.
I don't think they were chasing any trends at the time, because, like I've often said, the first two films were not that successful. They were only successful when they were re-released. Goldfinger was the one that really knocked it out of the park and was a big international hit, especially in America. It doesn't really, you know, nothing calls attention to following a trend on those Connery films. And I might be wrong, and somebody will say, oh, well, Diamonds Are Forever, it's because variety shows are big on TV. I have no idea. So they had it in Vegas and had celeb cameos and stuff that I think most were edited out.
That's true.
Before the film was finished. But no, they weren't trend chasing. Not at all. And that might have been Harry Saltzman's influence, because I think his last one was Diamonds, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he sold his interest in Bond. But yeah, no, you start to see it in the Moore films. But But, you know, like Spy Who Loved Me is a classic Moore film, and it's just a straight Bond adventure.
Because it was a dire situation at that point.
Yeah, so, that was a throw everything at the wall, and this is going to be the last one if it doesn't make it. Because Man with a Golden Gun bombed. Like, that was a flop. That lost money.
And it's not a good movie.
No, it's terrible.
Moonraker chased trends.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. But it was a huge hit. It was a gigantic hit. So I think with the Moore films, the problem is they chased trends, and for the most part, they were big hits. So much so that it's like Moore was in the role too long. We've talked about that before the show.
View to a Kill was where it was like,
View to a Kill should have been in it. They should have changed him in Octopussy, to be honest. And I was discussing this with Eric last week, but we were talking about how I didn't feel like Gen X was really into Bond, at least not in America. Like my generation, you know, guys my age didn't, were not into these movies.
It was a boomer.
And
thing.
I think it's because more, I think more drove away that generation in a way, because he was in the role too long. You're seeing this middle-aged man kick ass and, you know, look tired. And it just, I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, it wasn't so bad up to For Your Eyes Only, but after that, he should have been replaced. And it's almost like Brosnan kind of brought the millennials back to the fold, or kind of, you know, and Dalton had an uphill battle too, because he was following the Moore movies, which were so well established with audiences. So he's going back to this serious approach, and it just fell flat with the fans at the time.
Let's be honest. What brought the millennials to the fold was the video game.
Yes, yeah, probably. Yeah. That was my, you know, big introduction to Bond, you know, the movie too, but the game was huge, and it had all the Bond history in it. Like, you could play as Jaws in the multiplayer, or Baron Samedi, or Oddjob, you know. They had locate, like, they had a Moonraker level. They had a, they had levels from other movies. I'm blanking on which ones, Eric, but they, you know, the video game paid respect to the old Bond, you know?
That said, my wife was telling me the other day that she's never met anybody, at least our age, who's into Bond like I am. I think it's been kind of hard pressed to find somebody my age that likes James Bond as much as I do.
Well, I mean, I know, like, you know, one of my old students invited me to go see No Time to Die. So, you know,
but I'm just speaking from my own experience.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know that some of the younger generation do like the Craig movies somewhat, but because they're a little more tailored towards their tastes, with it's grittier, you know, there's more world building, you know.
Boring.
Yeah, if for the most part, but, like, you know, I like Skyfall quite a bit, but that's more of it's a Bond movie, you know. Like, it does do the world building stuff, but, you know, it has a lot more of the James Bond stuff you like. Like,
have they done with the latest Bonds? I've forgotten. I've not seen No Time to Die. It seems like they've ditched the exotic locations. Am I right there? That was a feature of a Bond film back in, I know, in the 70s, and especially in the 80s. It was, what location they go into this time? Or location?
Yeah, they were like travel logs in a way. Like, yeah, travel logs in action.
There's some, in No Time to Die has some exotic locations.
Okay.
It's not as showy as, like, say, Spy Who Loved Me.
No.
Which is like, you know, that has some very iconic location work. But
None of the Craig movies, none of the locations in the Craig movies cause attention to themselves, really.
Yeah, but, you know, they will film in, like, you know, this, you know, old European city, and they'll have a motorcycle chase through it, and it looks cool, you know.
But actually, you know, the opening to No Time to Die actually has a pretty good location in Italy when he goes to visit her grave. Yeah,
that's a great sequence. Yeah, and there's a good chase sequence there. No Time to Die, like, I was like, it's too long. I don't like what they did with the character, but the action scenes and the location is good, you know.
I'll watch it. I still don't have it, but I'm going to pick it up.
It's worth watching. It's not a
complete, I'm not going to knock it. Yeah, I'll definitely get it.
Yeah, because, like, something like Spectre or Quantum of Solace, like, I would be like, don't bother. This one has enough moments to justify a watch, you know.
Quantum has a good opera scene.
Yeah, it does. Mm. but so with License to Kill, I'm never really excited when Bond is in the United States. And I know he's kind of in Latin America here, but it still feels like the beginnings in America. Like, they're hanging out at Felix Leiter's house and
Key West.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the locations or noticed anything interesting, since I know you hail from Florida.
Sure do. I think Florida, I agree with you that the mystique is sort of disappears a little bit when he goes to the United States, with a few exceptions. Those exceptions being New Orleans, because Louisiana, it's basically its own freaking country. Yeah. And Florida is exotic enough that I'm okay with that because it's close to the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing more Caribbean than James Bond, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of locality. This is obviously a U.S. heavy one. I guess the only other exception that I can think of, and it's only because of how dangerous it feels. I was telling John this the other day that my favorite Roger Moore movie isn't The Usual Suspects, like The Spy Who Loved Me or For Your Eyes Only, although I like those movies a lot. It's the first one. It's Live and Let Die. And the reason for that is because it's the only one of the Roger Moore movies that actually feels dangerous to me. And no other Bond film can I think of where an entire race of people are against James Bond. And there's just something about the voodoo aspect of it. Some of the Louisiana locales, it just also actually Harlem, the Harlem sequence when he's in that bombed out part of Harlem where there's like a dilapidated neighborhood.
I'm not going to quote the scenes, but there are some hilarious, use of white slurs.
There is.
Isn't that the Haitians throughout the Bond in that one?
it's basically every black person. There's the Haitians later on in the film. Kananga, I think, is Haitian, I seem to recall. But the blacks in Harlem are all in his employ.
The Clintons.
Exactly. Yeah, it does sound like. And then also you get, we're getting off of locales, but you also get the iconic Roger Moore image, which is the black turtleneck that he wears at the end with the Dirty Harry gun.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Which is a cool image even now. It's one of the, in fact, it's the only fashion of the Moore era that still holds up.
What's the one with Moore where he's, racing across and he uses the crocodiles as a
film.
That's
a great sequence. That sequence is so James Bond in a low tier kind of way because it's not like he's in a giant hollowed out volcano where he's stuck in this trap. It's some guy's backyard basically, but it's still a very classic Bondian escape where his gadget actually doesn't work, so he has to do that great stunt jumping over the alligators.
And I heard about how they did that. And, you know, the guy who ran the alligator farm basically put on Roger Moore's pants and ran across.
Yeah, actually did it. You know, real stunts. Who can imagine?
Yeah, real stunts.
This movie has a connection to Live and Let Die. The guy who plays it's a return Felix Leiter performance with David Hemmings.
And the movie Edison. Takes heavily David from Edison. The book.
Edison,
right. And the movie License to Kill, that is, takes probably more from Live and Let Die book than Live and Let Die does, I think.
I remember
quite a lot
reading that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a connection.
The shark sequence, I think.
The shark sequence, it's what happens in the book is his arm is eaten by alligators. But yeah, I guess now that I think about it, I wonder if that was why they brought back Hedison to sort of make a connective tissue with that movie and this one.
I remember I saw an interview with David Hedison where he said, you know, he wanted to come back as Felix Leiter, and he goes, I think the director was expecting me to show up with a walker, like just be extremely old and decrepit because the last movie I was in was Live and Let Die.
Could you get Jack Lord for this one, or was he dead?
He was
already Alzheimer's and living in like a hermit.
He's
a nutbag.
Yeah, he was.
Jack Lord? Really? Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was supposed to show up as Felix Leiter for whenever they needed a Felix Leiter throughout the series, and he screwed that up big time by asking for the same amount that Sean Connery made.
He wanted him to be like on the same level.
Yeah.
Was he doing the Wi-Fi High by that time or not? No, that was later. That was much later. Yeah.
He was offered Star Trek, Captain Kirk, and he demanded ownership of half the series.
Unbelievable.
Offered that because Star Trek, the set designs are very inspired by Dr. No, and it was natural that they asked the guy who was in Dr. No to play Kirk, and he demanded ownership of half the series.
You know what? I will give Jack Law this much. He at least chanced his arm and said, oh, I'm going to try. If I don't, I don't care. I'm not going to bother.
Yeah.
Good on him.
Well,
he was wise to the business, if anything. Yeah,
but the Star Trek connection makes sense, because I remember the first time I saw Dr. No, the final act, I was like, this looks like Star Trek. You know?
Yes.
Wi-Fi is a kick-ass show. Fuck, I need to get that series.
Jack Lord and Hedison are both too old to be in this movie.
Yeah.
Should be somebody closer to Dalton's age.
Well, we know.
No, no, thanks.
No.
He had that guy in the previous, he was bland as all hell, but he had a good look. I looked it up. John Terry played Felix Leiter in Living Daylights. He has a very small scene. And like he looks like basically an American James Bond, which is pretty much what that character needs to be anyway.
Yeah. Instead, we get Jeffrey Wright, who just looks depressed, and he's basically as Jim Gordon's the same.
Yeah.
He just kind of mumbles.
Yeah, he was okay in that first one. I don't remember how he did in Quantum.
He just seems like he's drunk in a bar and bored. Yeah. In the first one, he actually brought some kind of suave cool to it. He's like Felix Leiter, he tried to bring some cool to it, but the other ones he's in, he kind of just seems checked out.
Bernie Casey's better and Never Say Never.
True.
That's all I'm going to say. In fact, Bernie Casey might, I'm looking at a list here. I made a list of all the, Felix Leiters, and my favorite would be Jack Lord. It's a shame he's a nutbag. David Hedison used to be my favorite just because he showed up twice. But now that I look at him, it's no. Who's the worst one? I think it's Diamonds, the guy we have for Diamonds, Norman Burton. He shows up fat. He's got a pink tie or something. Looks terrible.
Looks ready for Vegas, baby.
Yeah, he sure does. Another bad one is a guy named Seck Linder who played him in Goldfinger. He's got that stupid hat at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, he's pretty unmemorable.
Yeah, Thunderball's Rick Van Nutter, who did a couple of spaghetti westerns. He's got a weird look because he looks like an albino on screen every time I see him. So honestly, John Terry's got a good look, although his acting is really bland. I'm going for either Jack Lord as the best or Bernie Casey ain't bad. Never say never again. Jack Instant Lord. Cool.
Yeah, Jack Lord's great. I think a Dr. No.
Yeah. He's really good.
What do we think of the theme song for this film? Kind of there.
It's okay.
It's not one I dislike.
I used to like it more than the Aha one, but now I think I like the Aha one a lot better.
Yeah, I like the Aha one more.
What's her name? Something Knight?
Gladys Knight.
Gladys Knight.
Without the pips.
Yeah. I don't think you get that reference, John.
I do not.
Oh, yeah, was Gladys Knight the pips were a huge band.
Gladys Knight the pips. What year? What decade?
Like late 60s, early 70s, soul music.
Yeah.
Yeah, Midnight Train to Georgia, I think, was their big
hit. Oh, yeah, sure. I know that. That plays all the time on the oldies station. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Strange choice for a theme song. Not Gladys Knight, obviously, as a singer, but she was hardly sort of relevant in 89.
Yeah, I never understood why they didn't get Diana Ross to do a Bond theme. I've never understood that.
You know what they should have done? They should have gotten Tina Turner, and they could have got Tim Capello to play the sax. She could have played the villain. She could have been Sanchez.
Could have been a total Tina Turner worship.
Yeah. When did they start getting kind of up to the minute artists? Because it didn't start off that way. I guess what's her face for You Only Live Twice? Nancy Sinatra.
They did it with Wings, with Live and Let Die.
Yeah. No, but Nancy was big at the time that she did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Tom Jones was big when he did Thunderball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Really kind of from the start, yeah.
Well, you know, the Three Blind Mice guys, they were burning up the charts.
Well, the funny thing is, From Russia With Love has the Matt Monro theme song, and Matt Monro, I think, was big everywhere except America, which it was the same with From Russia With Love. I think it did well in every market except for the US. So it's kind of fitting. And I think after that, they started aiming for trendier singers who were big in America.
Well, lately, like, you know, we've got the trendiest, you know, there's Billie Eilish and Sam Harris. Oh. And gosh, who did? Oh, Adele with Skyfall, which was a good choice, I think.
That was a good choice. That was a good song. Yeah. I do enjoy
good
that
song. Too, good too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But man, one of the worst, though, is the Jack White, Alicia Keys, Quantum.
Oh, God.
Good. Yeah.
Garbage. But I liked the Chris Cornell one.
I like that Jack White one more than I do the Madonna one for Die Another Day. That
oh, sure. Word. Yeah, of course.
I forgot she did one for Die Another Day.
I remember, you know who hated that song and like wouldn't let it go in the press was Elton John. Like, he would take every opportunity to take a dump on that song. Like, he'd be on the red carpet, Madonna would be there, and he would just be like, hey, you know what the worst Bond theme song is? Die Another Day.
Did he have one rejected for that?
Hold on, Sir Elton.
He's had a catty feud with her around the time, I think.
Oh, so that's man. Okay. He was just, like, to anyone who would listen, he would talk about how much that song sucks.
Who's the greatest artist that never did, or who's the one artist you would have liked to have heard done a Bond song but never did?
Alice Cooper. No.
Well, he did.
I know, that's the joke.
Yeah, I see.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question.
I would say Queen would have been a good one in the 80s.
Sure, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. You got the flamboyance, you got the high notes, you got it all there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think
that's not bad. It's a good choice.
I think Europe. Just Danger on the Track. That's your Bond opening.
Danger. Should have done a Bond theme.
Ooh. Cause you kind of, I'm sure there's somebody who I've thought, why haven't they done one? That would have been swell.
Metallica.
Yeah.
Engelbert Humperdinck.
Lizzo.
Oh, Jesus.
Don't speak too soon.
If it would have been Engelbert, it probably would have been early Sean Connery era.
Wayne Newton.
That's Wayne Newton. I always thought the show should, or the franchise should remain, is like in that Connery era. Like with that style and
the loungy music. Feel. Yeah. The torch singer and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of that way.
Who would be good? Somebody say Korn? Did I hear Korn?
Korn. No. Korn. No. Coal Chamber.
Sepultura. Sepultura. Yeah. It's the one where they go to Brazil. Yeah. James Bond is in Sao Paulo.
Glenn Danzig doing his worst Elvis. Oh, no.
Wow.
That would be actually interesting to hear a Danzig
Bond James song. Bond movie. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How about let Danzig direct, too? How about that?
Yeah. It'll be set in a saloon. Everybody's gonna be wearing black leather.
Why do all the Bond girls have massive knockers? You know.
Yeah. When I saw that trailer to the Western, I was just like, "This is gonna be set all in the brothel." No thanks.
So, are we gonna cover that Danzig film when we get our hands on it, or what?
Might as well. There's two of them now. I think he's doing a third.
The director of one of those follows me on Twitter. I have no idea how that happened, but. There we go.
Henry Danzig, is it?
Henry Danzig.
Hey, Danzig.
But the Ramones.
No, they did Rock and Roll High School. That's it.
Rock and Roll High School.
I'm trying to think of somebody who would have been a real knockout. Let's see. Twisted Sister.
Michael Bublé. Has he done a theme?
Michael Bublé would be a good choice. That's a open and shut. Like, why hasn't that happened yet? Oh, Scott Michael Walker. Bolton. There you go.
Michael Bolton.
Michael Bolton. Michael Bolton's Bond song would just be him describing the plot.
Lonely Island.
Yes.
Lonely Island.
This is the tale of James Bond, Secret Service agent.
I'll try that out. Who was the one that sort of got away? Obviously, Queen, we won't get.
Well, Queen would be the winner of that one, yeah.
Yeah. I
mean, most of those were joke responses, but Queen would definitely is the one that got away.
That's where Ross Mulcahy got smart. He said, Flash Gordon, that was good music, but there was no songs. Let's get the songs.
Yeah, let's get the songs in there. Yeah. I think, you know what's one that got away? Ronnie James Dio.
Black Sabbath. Imagine that is a fun song.
Yeah, there you go. What about Prince?
I was going to mention, because what's his face? Her protege did For Your Eyes Only, right?
That's right.
Sheena Easton.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think Prince would in the 80s would have been a pretty solid choice.
Prince should have done a Batman score soundtrack.
Mm.
Would have been good.
What about Phil Collins?
No.
He already ruined Tarzan.
Yeah.
What about a Genesis song for Bond? Huh?
Yeah.
Huh? Oh, Asia.
There you go.
There you go.
There's one that got away.
Yeah. Men at Work.
Fuck off.
What about Oingo Boingo?
It's a mistake. Oingo Boingo with blackface.
Oh, no.
All right, here's Bond. Who's the next Bond? Who plays Bond next?
Ooh. Barbara Broccoli has hinted that they're going to take another break. And I think they're kind of trying to wait for the
politics to blow over.
I think they're waiting for the culture to kind of calm down.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they want to change the character to somebody, another race or another gender or something.
That's partially why we got Daniel Craig as long as we did, I suspect.
Yes. I think because Daniel Craig, like Elton John, to anyone who would listen, would just complain about playing James Bond to everybody.
Yeah. It was the worst job in the world, according to
him. Oh, he just constantly whinged. And I remember every time he put out a new one going, oh, this will be the last one, you know. But I think they kept him around just because they didn't want to have to recast, and they just saw the culture getting crazier and crazier, and just going.
He had the Jaws 4 effect with him with Michael Caine. I didn't see the film, but I remember the house that bought me.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Or houses that bought me, I should say.
Yeah.
Mansions.
They screwed that guy's continuity up so bad. Like already by Skyfall, the third movie, he's old and he's out of it. Like, wait, what? We just got here. What are you talking about?
Yeah. I think if they, whoever they get, I think they're going to want to get someone they can get some mileage out of. Kind of like I think that's part of the decision to cast Pattinson.
Robert
as Pattinson. As Batman, because he's a little bit younger. But, you know, I think they might try to go with someone a little younger because, you know, every idiot's like, oh, Idris Elba should play James Bond. Idris Elba's like, I'm too old to play this role. Like,
even he's acknowledged he's too old.
Yeah, Idris Elba is like, that's ridiculous. Like, you know, they'll get like maybe one movie out of me.
They need to get somebody who's in their very late 20s who can play older, who can play like 35.
Yeah.
And somebody make like who's good. Nine of those movies. Yeah.
Yeah. There's
lots of actors on British television that they could choose from. There's tons of. There's all these handsome guys. They're in their 20s. They could play Bond. There's plenty of them. You never go with somebody who's well known because then you got to work against that image.
They never do though.
Yeah.
Roger Moore was a TV star. Sean Connery was basically a nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Lazenby was a complete nobody.
Yeah.
Dalton, you know, not like a household name. They always go with somebody who's not a movie star.
Brosnan was Remington Steele.
Mm-hmm.
I say look at British television right now and pick out three candidates. It's going to be one of them.
And
just watch episodes of The Bill and pick someone from there.
You know who was in the role, in the running against Craig, who nearly got the role, was Henry Cavill.
Yep. Are you serious?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We probably would have been better off with that.
Yeah, I think so. I think they went with Craig because they wanted somebody with darker vibes. because Cavill is much more wholesome.
I don't know. Cavill looks like a date rapist. That's why I don't like him as Superman. That's fine for Bond, but not Superman.
Cavill claims he didn't get the role because Martin Campbell looked at him and said he was too chubby to play Bond, apparently.
Well, I know that Cavill has that fat kid complex.
Yeah.
He said he was a fat kid and he met Russell Crowe.
he's got fat brain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The Russell Crowe, I mean, not Russell Crowe. Henry Cavill is a fat kid inside, you know?
Yeah. I kind of see it now that you mention it.
But, you know, but I thought I liked him a lot in Man from U.N.C.L.E. You know, I thought he, you know, wore the tux well, and, you know, the shots where Guy Ritchie has the light going across his eyes with the silence gun, you know, I thought it looked pretty cool. So,
but how would you feel about him taking the role now?
Or is he too old? Too old.
Too old. Okay.
Yeah. I think they need some, like John said, look at British TV, get somebody from there. You know, there's so many good British shows with good actors that are young and handsome.
I mean, it could be anybody from the colonies too. Stitched.
What?
Clive Owen's been stitched up, man.
Oh, everybody always says Clive Owen. I'm like, he's way too old.
Yeah, he's 57, but shit.
We would have been better.
He lobbied hard for Casino Royale. He lobbied very hard for Casino Royale, and his agent kind of screwed him over because he asked for too much money.
And another person who keeps coming up is Tom Hardy. I don't see that.
Because he wants to play the role, but he's too well known, and
he's too well. Yeah, I mean,
he's a small guy. I don't think he actually should play him.
He's for you.
It'll be an unknown. At least that's what I prefer.
Same. Just get somebody. So get some guy from a PBS or BBC show. You know.
And I really wish they don't do the just because it's a young guy. I really wish they don't do the young years. I'd rather just it be right off the bat. He's been an agent for a few years already.
We did the origin story with Casino, and we don't need to do it again. But as we've seen,
that hasn't stopped the Spider-Man movies.
It hasn't stopped the Batman, because everybody's like, we got the dark, gritty Batman, and it's like, didn't we get that in 2005 whenever that Batman Begins
came? Didn't we get it in 89?
Oh, yeah, arguably we got it in 89 too, which is people
forget. Yeah. Crazy.
That was a dark film in 89, believe me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Compared to Adam West.
I wasn't allowed to see it.
Yeah. I wasn't allowed to see Batman Returns. No way. My mom saw the Penguin on those McDonald's cups and said, no, sir.
Your mom saw the Penguin and said, shit, this is Colin Farrell.
Yeah. I think if the Penguin looked like Colin Farrell, it might have worked in my favor.
Well, we've talked nothing of License to Kill.
True. We've just been talking Bond in a bigger, more broad fashion. But also, this movie, so License to Kill, is it typical of Bond movies? I was thinking about this when I was watching it. They spend a good chunk of the film in a fictional country.
Yeah.
Isthmus City. And I was going, is that a real place? And I looked it up and no, it's for the movie. And I was thinking, do James Bond films, do they often make up countries or locales? Is that a common thing in this series?
Maybe they do now, to not step on anybody's toes, but not previous to this that I can think of.
No.
So I remember thinking that was unusual when I was watching this, that they wouldn't set it in like Panama or, one of those places, one of those actual Caribbean locales to promote the,
Yeah. Well, there's nothing really to it because whatever the fake name is, it's basically Colombia, and it makes Colombia look like a fucking shithole. So
yeah.
What do you mean makes it look like a fucking shithole?
Well, it is, but that's besides the point.
Also, Eric, did you like that Shang Tsung was the Hong Kong undercover cop?
I didn't recognize him, but now that you tell me that sounds great.
Yeah, yes. That was Shang Tsung from Paul W.S. Anderson's Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, well, anytime a ninja shows up in a Bond movie, you know it's going to be okay.
Yeah, yeah. Like, he showed up, and I was like, hey, it's Shang Tsung, but then he commits suicide pretty quick.
Right away. Yeah, it's pretty brutal, too.
Have we ever had El Leong in a Bond film? No, we haven't, have we?
Surprisingly not. I'm not very familiar with the Pierce Brosnan movies. I saw those once years ago, and I never saw them again because they were not.
He might have been, yeah.
I think that was a little after A-L, A-A, after Al, you know.
Yeah. Well, they don't use a lot of L.A. stunt guys. They very rarely use Hollywood stunt people. They use, like, British stunt guys. And what's his name? Victor Armstrong. He kind of directs a lot of the action, and they use British stuntmen and, you know, probably stuntmen from Asia and whatever locale they're filming in. But I don't think they use a lot of American stuntmen for those.
This is the last time Bond smoked. I don't even think Dalton smoked in Living in Daylights, did he?
Yeah, he did.
Okay. Because
I remember Dalton very deliberately wanted Bond to smoke because he thought it would be edgier.
Well, also, he was reading the novels and he smokes like a chimney in the novels.
He smokes like 30 packs a day. That's not even a joke.
Sweet.
If James Bond were a real guy, if the literary Bond were a real guy, he would smell and look like garbage.
You know who James Bond would be if he was a real person? He'd be Cancer Man from X-Files.
Yeah. Oh, Mickey Rourke.
He eats like garbage, too. It's all that fancy foods, caviar and stuff. All that stuff's not good for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he'd be dead by 50, I think, if he were real in the Fleming novels. I mean, dead like Fleming. Fleming died in the middle age.
Right. And they make fun of that in Never Say Never Again, where he has to get rid of the free radicals from his body. He has to go to the health club.
Oh, my gosh. He would also, you know, never mind all the STDs he's picked up along the way, too.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, sure.
What about the Bond girls? Do you think this is the last time that we had honest to goodness, like, good looking girls in the movies?
I really liked Carrie Lowell a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought she was very easy on the eyes. But as far as the last time, okay, in GoldenEye, we had, I like Famke Janssen. She was in that.
She's a great oddball type villain.
Yeah.
That might be the last of those types. Yeah.
I am partial to Denise Richards. In that terrible Bond film.
Sure.
Yeah, she's great, an awful actress. She's
terrible. Yeah.
She is very easy to look at.
Okay. Her. Michelle Yeoh in Tomorrow Never Dies, no. Terry Hatcher, yes.
Terry Hatcher's okay, yeah.
Yeah, I like Terry Hatcher. I'm going to...
Well, that Olga Kurylenko.
Kurylenko, yeah. She's pretty hot.
Nice. Yeah.
Wish the movie was better, but she's hot.
Yeah, true.
I suppose what I mean really is like classic Bond girl, where they're not, because all these movies that we're talking about, it's like the girls are trying to up Bond, you know, in the tough factor. Famke Janssen, Olga.
Well, Famke Janssen, she's a Bond girl, but she's also like a villain.
Halle Berry is another one I'm thinking of, where it's like they're trying to make her equal.
Yeah, Bond. I didn't like that.
Is there even such a thing as a Bond girl these days? Isn't it seen as...
They've apparently struck it from being mentioned at all on set, if you could believe that.
Yeah, I can't believe that, actually.
Because you'd get a call from HR. Daniel Craig would have to get booted from the set.
Please do.
Improprieties.
Please do. I wish.
Because it's like the Bond movies are made by gays now. You know.
Yeah.
They're made by homos.
I don't even remember the girls in Skyfall, even though I liked that movie.
I don't remember. They died, didn't they? Didn't one of them die? She had a brutal death.
I guess. I mean, like, I remember. What was it?
Nothing.
I remember. So in Quantum of Solace, I remember one of the reviews was like, James is just so miserable in this movie. He only sleeps with one woman.
And they used to give Timothy Dalton shit for that because he didn't sleep with the girls like Roger Moore did because of the whole AIDS thing.
Yeah.
So suddenly they had to relate that to heterosexual characters.
Speaking of that kind of stuff, John, don't knock the gays. I think a gay made the best one, actually.
Oh, really?
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Oh, is Peter Hunt gay?
Peter Hunt's gay.
Oh, well,
was gay. Know that.
Well, one of the writers of Goldfinger was gay.
He died of AIDS. I made that up.
Yeah, one of the Goldfinger scribes was gay. Okay. For the one who supposedly was an actual spy, Anthony Nesbitt was telling me about him, that he still has a sealed file at the British Espionage Agency or whatever, but he co-wrote Goldfinger, and he lived with Laurie Johnson, the male composer of all those British TV shows like The Avengers and The Professionals.
Yeah, Charles needs to know that sort of stuff. No one else knows his name.
I haven't heard one Sanchez this entire podcast.
Yeah, why haven't we been talking about the number of times David Hedison says Sanchez?
Drinking game.
Sanchez! Oh, and just the plot at the beginning where he's going to ditch the wedding to go catch this
that's ridiculous.
Oh, it's so silly.
He doesn't give a shit about his wife anyway.
The dude who, and that black guy who plays like the angry chief in every cop show is like, what am I going to tell her? Isn't he the guy in Last Action Hero who's like the chief with steam coming out of his ears?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think he is. Yeah.
Like every time he talks to Schwarzenegger, he's like, I solved the case.
He's the black, what's his name? Dennis Franz.
Yes, Dennis Franz. Anytime you need a surly alcoholic cop, you call Dennis Franz.
Yeah. Or his black counterpart being this guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, note this is the first movie where Bond goes rogue, which is now a cliche in all the Daniel Craig movies.
Yeah, and because I remember when I first saw this, I had recently seen Mission Impossible and going, oh, it's like Mission Impossible. Because, you know, that was when Ethan Hunt goes rogue.
He goes rogue.
He's off the grid. And I remember thinking even in the 90s, that was becoming a cliche. Like the agent goes rogue. He plays by his own rules. And even when Bond goes rogue, like they don't seem to care. They're like, he'll come back.
Were they going to execute him?
Yeah, they were like shooting at him, and M's like, that's fine. And then Q goes out into the field to help him out. Now, one thing I like about this movie, I always like it when Q is out running around with Bond, like an octopussy. It's always great when Desmond Llewellyn gets to like run around with him and stay at the hotel and go fishing and that stuff.
This is his favorite movie, Desmond Llewellyn, because he said he got the most lines he ever had as Q.
Yeah.
The most screen time.
Because in a lot of the movies, it's just, we're in the laboratory 007. No, don't touch that 007.
Bring it back in one piece.
Bring it back. You won't muck it up like you did in Beirut.
I always like about the Roger Moore movies, he looks like he's screwing with his stuff on purpose. Like, James is just in there bullying him. You know, he's like.
Roger Moore's James always kind of looks like a cat that's about to do something.
Yeah.
Kind of looks before he knocks the books off the shelf.
He's a total prick, and there's like this myth that he got rid of the misogyny of the Sean Connery Bonds. That's complete baloney because he's mean as hell to women and men with a gun.
The reason they say that is he doesn't beat the women.
He just bends their arm a little.
He doesn't, like in the first two, he kind of goes, I'll break your arm, but he stops doing that. He stops doing that, but yeah, it's like his version of misogyny is verbal, whereas Sean was like, I'm going to hit you.
he just slapped them right away.
Sometimes you just have to hit a woman, you know.
It's called mood control.
Yeah.
But I also noticed that Dalton alienated the press a lot with his two films because he wasn't real friendly with the press, and Roger Moore for like, you know, since Live and Let Die, loved talking to the press. And you'll notice you go to YouTube, there's a ton of Roger Moore appearances on like shows like Dick Cavett, like him just going up and Johnny Carson just yucking it up with, because he loved the attention and he loved talking to reporters and talk show hosts, and Dalton didn't like the publicity part of
you gotta go be James Bond if you're gonna play the part.
I've listened to a few Dalton interviews. He's actually a bore to listen to.
Yeah. And that's something that sucked about Craig was he was like, he just constantly bitched about playing James Bond. And it was like,
yeah, he wasn't having fun.
Nobody wants to hear you complain about being the world's sexiest man. You know, like no guy, you know, go be James Bond. Don't. But he was just a miserable James Bond, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, Craig forced him to sign on the dotted line for the film. He could have just said, nah, I'm out.
They kept, probably because of the political angle where they wanted to keep the guy so they wouldn't have to change the race or the sex or whatever. Like they just kept, they lined up the Brinks truck every time so that he couldn't say no.
Oh, that's why the latest one took forever to come out, because he was toying with him.
Yeah, that was his fault. He delayed it.
And
something like $60 million apparently that's on the books.
And you know, for him, their choice of director too was to get like a guy who directs movies for women, you know, Carrie Fukunaga.
Who's now getting Me Too'd like crazy.
Oh, is he really?
The only director getting Me Too'd right
What's
now.
What's going on?
Really?
Women complaining about his behavior on the set.
They called him this actress called him a groomer.
I thought you said a gook. I was like, holy shit, really?
No. Then she would be the one in trouble.
he got Me Too'd by Lee Tamahori.
yeah. Oh man, you want to talk about Bond directors with questionable sexual histories?
Oh boy,
that was me getting a New Zealander.
Yeah,
no damn fault.
Yep.
No sympathy. Yep.
What's Lee Tamahori been up to lately? I'm curious. Last thing I remember him doing was like the XXX movie with
Walking Ice the Cube. Streets of Las Vegas.
What's old Lee up to? Oh, yeah, he did The Devil's Double. You remember that one?
No.
It was like Scarface in Iraq, but with Saddam Hussein's.
Oh, son. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, weird.
Mahana. He did a movie called Mahana with Tamura Morrison. Ooh.
Hmm.
In 2016. It's a New Zealand film. So he's out of Hollywood. He's back to New Zealand. He's back making movies with sheep.
He's now the Ed Wood of New Zealand. Yeah.
But yeah, old Lee Tamahori. He did Mulholland Falls. Yeah, Devil's Double. That was a decent movie. It was worth watching.
I was just pointing out like 2011, how long ago that was. Yeah, Mulholland Falls is basically James Ellroy light, right?
Yeah.
I tried watching it. It was terrible.
I've always heard it was awful, but it has its fans. There are people who love that movie. I don't know. I've never
watched it. I tried getting through it on, I think it was Prime or something. I was just like, I cannot sit through this. This is bad.
And he did David Mamet's The Edge. It's the other one.
Or remember, there's people that love James Ellroy Light, like L.A. Confidential, that movie.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Which almost has nothing to do with the novel.
Ellroy's not a fan of that film, is he, John?
Not really, no. He says it's entertaining, it's watchable, but he thinks it's a safe studio movie. He was baffled that LAPD officers in the 1950s or late 40s never use racial slurs ever.
Speaking of super light James Ellroy, it's basically spaghetti western light. Did you guys remember Gangster Squad?
Yeah, I found it at Dollar Tree and tried to watch it and I gave up after 20 minutes.
It's not worth a dollar either.
Yeah,
never seen it. Never. No, I haven't seen it.
It's like an Ellroy novel, but with just like it's retarded and has shoot 'em ups. It's basically that's all that it is.
Yeah.
There's a scene where they're playing hot potato between two cars in a car chase with a grenade, you know, that kind of stuff.
Oh, jeez.
Which sounds great on paper, but.
Yeah. It's just awkward on film.
Yeah.
Because it's too far fetched. Well, it's kind of like at the end of the License to Kill, there's like, as my cousin said after he saw it, he was disappointed in the finale. He said, I can buy James Bond scuba diving, karate, you know, sharpshooter, even flying a plane. But James Bond 18-wheeler stunt driver is a little hard.
Yeah.
Yes.
I remember thinking the the chase at the end itself, which apparently was shot in a very treacherous road in Mexico. I remember thinking like, oh man, this is actually really awesome. This is like the convoy truck chase in Raiders of the Lost Ark. But rewatching it this time, it was, outside of a few things here and there, it was pretty underwhelming.
Yeah. Well, the real problem with this film, which, you know, I like to a certain extent, and I really wish Dalton had done more, more of the movies. But it's funny because a month before it opened, I bought an issue of Cine Fantastique. This was the cover story. They had this detailed coverage of it. And John Glenn was saying, oh, this is going to be like more like a Kiss Me Deadly type of movie, you know, the Ralph Meeker film that Robert Aldrich made, or, you know, is it going to be more like a return to the Mickey Spillane influence of James Bond? It's going to be hard edged and really violent and tough and like a noir film. And then I go see the film, and then Wayne Newton shows up and completely kills all that pre-press.
Bless your heart.
Oh. Yeah. Even excise him out of the movie, and it's still not anywhere near what that description is. So.
Yeah. And I understand there's a fan edit that completely eliminates Wayne Newton and kills Felix Leiter in the beginning, which when I saw the film opening day, I thought Felix Leiter was dead. Then he shows up at the end, flirting with a nurse, not even caring about his dead wife, and laughing it up and smacking the nurse on the ass. And, hey, James, hey, you had a great time getting revenge for me. And
it makes you wonder, like, if they watched the movie before they released it.
Yeah, I don't even think they must have edited that down to the wire and didn't even screen it for tone or anything, because that scene blew it. It's just like, it should have been Felix thanking him, being real somber and kind of quiet, kind of end on a dark note.
Well, it killed the weight of it, because the whole movie is James going to get revenge. And he's like, and he's so angry, like, oh, Felix and his wife. And then at the end, Felix is like, hey, James, glad you did that. Hey, sweetie, over here, iced tea, right? Yeah. And it's like, wait.
The filmmaker's argument would be, well, he didn't care about the wife at the start by him forgetting, oh, I'm getting married. So why is he going to worry about the wife when she's dead?
Well, then why should James care? Why should we care? You know?
Yeah.
You know.
Romance. I don't know.
I just wanted more Big Ed from Twin Peaks.
I think Sharky's playing, he's a relative of Quirrell from Dr. No, I think.
$4 million's a real chunk of change, amigo. He's the character who really made me feel like it was like some Florida cop show.
Well, it's got that kind of Joel Silver movie wannabe vibe. And, you know, there's probably too many American actors in it, which kind of kills the exoticism of a 007. And I think there's often that problem when you have the American, when the Bond girl is American.
Yes.
There's like a sort of, there's a faultiness there. And I was reading up on the production of this, and supposedly they were planning the next one, Property of a Lady, and the three directors they had lined up were all from North America. It was like John Landis or Ted Nugent, who was Canadian, or John Byram, who had directed the Bill Murray Razor's Edge.
Well, didn't John Landis work on Spy Who Loved Me?
He worked on the script and the Moonraker script.
He worked on Moonraker. There's elements of it still of John in Moonraker, but with Spy Who Loved Me, they brought him in that early, and he made this opening scene. He wrote an opening sequence where Roger Moore is like in Colombia or something, and he's running from these death squad type cops or federales or whatever they got down there. And he hides behind a crucifix of Jesus in a church. And it's got Roger Moore, you know, in the Christ pose. And apparently he was kicked out of Cubby's office. Cubby was just like, what the fuck do you think we're making here?
John Landis has to put some blasphemy in there.
You know, of course.
To offend the people he doesn't like, you know.
Yeah.
Lucky he might have killed Roger Moore. Had he been on the
well, you know, he probably would have dropped a helicopter on him, you know. And then he probably would have hired some minority kids under the table, you know, to
he would have said is there any
just increase his body Vietnam? Count, you know.
The real Vietnam happened on the set of the Twilight Zone.
Yeah. No, but yeah, John Landis would have been a terrible choice to direct a Bond film. Like, I guess.
What about Tony Scott?
Yeah.
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 Under some control, yeah. He would have been good for it.
There you go.
I mean,
he had an eye for the ladies. He liked his action scenes big and loud.
And he was slick. Yeah. Slick. You know.
Beverly Hills Cop 2. Holy shit. That would have been, I mean, that's not a bad film, but it looks great.
Yeah, Beverly Hills Cop 2, like, you know, the first Beverly Hills Cop film is just so straightforward visually. Mm-hmm. Beverly Hills Cop 2 looks amazing. It's not as good as the first one at all, but you know, I remember going, dang, this is a good-looking movie. Good.
Yeah. Tony Scott would have made a better A View to a Kill than John Glenn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He would have made that a much better movie.
John and I talked about, off of the back of Man from Hong Kong, that instead of getting Scott Glenn to be the Bond director of the 80s, they should have just gotten Brian Trenchard Smith. Did I say Glenn. Scott Glenn? Yeah. Whoops. John Glenn. Wrong.
Scott Glenn. That's the cranky, smoking, drinking Bond. Yeah. Scott Glenn. Yeah, yeah. Brian Trenchard Smith, I think.
You don't think so? Not by the 80s, then, I think.
I don't even like his style much, really. I don't care much. I don't think any of his films I like.
I like Man from Hong Kong, and I like that Drive-In. Drive-In of the Damned is good.
I like Dead End Drive-In. That's
Dead End Drive-In and Man from Hong Kong. Everything else I could care less about, but those two.
I watched Turkey Shoot, and I thought that was the biggest piece of shit.
It's a piece of shit. Yeah.
Awful.
Maybe I think he knew he was making a piece of crap with that one. That's why there's so much stupid, ridiculous stuff in it.
Yeah. Oh, it's bad.
But yeah, anyway,
I want to see Stunt Rock, so I do want to see that one. Sorry.
It's good for the Australian stuntman. I forget his name, but he's really cool in that movie.
Grant Page?
Yeah, yeah. He's really cool in the film. And that band Sorcery is not bad. The problem is the movie just has nothing. Nothing's really happening in it. You're just seeing stunts and then music performance. There's no
the stunt reel.
Yeah, yeah. There's no cohesive storyline, really. But it's watchable. And Grant's really cool. It's just like there's no men working in movies like that anymore. These guys who look like they probably, you know, they did some cliff diving and then they had like a whiskey sour and then they did some hang gliding and then they, you know, had a six pack and then they went on their motorcycles for the rest of the day.
And they were listening to You Blew It All Sky High.
Yeah, yeah.
Listening to the all hang gliding.
Again. How about Jigsaw for a Bond movie? Bond theme.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That would have worked.
Get some Jigsaw in there. Yeah, there's one that got away. Jigsaw.
Badfinger doing a Bond theme.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about
Leonard? I give this a 6 out of 10.
That's what I gave it as well. I was kind of, you know, I was like, I really did enjoy it. Going back to it, I hadn't seen this since I saw it on TBS, as I mentioned earlier. But when I went back to it, at first I was kind of like, okay, this is Bond in America, you know, whatever. But I had fun, you know, Carrie Lowell's Easy on the Eyes.
So is the other one.
Yeah.
Felicia Soto.
Felicia Soto, yeah. Another Mortal Kombat.
That's right. Annihilation, right?
Oh, dang.
And Vampirella.
Yeah, the worthless Jim Wynorski Vampirella.
Yeah, needed to be a bit more top heavy, I think.
You know, Bond's driving 18 wheelers instead of Aston Martins. Mm. You know, it's the 80s. Bigger is better.
He's got Engelbert Humperdinck sideburns.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, Dalton is good again. He's good as Bond. Yeah. I wish he would have continued. I think Dalton was better than the movies allowed him. Than the movies were. I think he was better than the material.
Oh man, Living Daylights is still my favorite Bond.
I do like Living Daylights quite a bit.
Man, I love it.
I regularly put that in like my top Bond. Not very top, but like, you know, it's up there for me.
Wish you would have done at least one more.
Yeah, like Lazenby, he just didn't really. He just that there wasn't the time to really get to know the character.
My hope for Lazenby, had he continued, would be that Diamonds would continue on with the tone that Majesty had started. Because if they would have just done Lazenby and the Diamonds Are Forever we have now, then it still would have been a piece of shit.
Yeah. Oh, Diamonds Are Forever is one of my least favorite James Bond movies.
It's the worst.
I hate it.
It's not the worst. There's worse ones. But
there's worse. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think is the worst James Bond movie?
Spectre and Quantum are up there.
Spectre, a view to a kill. I hate a view to a kill.
I gotta say, Spectre. I'm gonna give Spectre this. It has a great opening, the Bond opening action scene. That Dia de los Muertos thing, I think, is excellent.
Yeah.
Quantum is pretty irredeemable, but it's short.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. Spectre is about 2.5 hours.
Spectre is long and it's boring. But I will say, every time I've tried watching View to a Kill recently, I can't get through it.
I don't think it's great, but it's no way near as bad as Spectre.
Spectre is awful. But I give it some props for the opening. But everything after that is just snoozeville.
Yeah, of the small faults. The minor faults that are in License to Kill, and it's not a great film, but it's not terrible. 2 hours and 13 minutes is just far too long for that film.
As the kids would say, License to Kill is mid as far as James Bond movies go.
It's very low scale for a Bond film.
Like, my wife popped in for parts of it and she goes, this doesn't really feel like a James Bond movie.
But 133 minutes is just ridiculous for this. It's just too long.
Yeah, did you two see it in the theater?
I did. I saw it.
No, I caught it on VHS when it came out.
But you could cut out all that Wayne Newton junk, you know.
Mm.
The sad thing is I liked it more when I watched it on VHS in like pan and scan. I thought it came off better, I guess, because I was more focused on the performances instead of waiting for big action scenes that never happened. You know, so it didn't feel like a waste. For some reason, it just came off better on VHS. I don't know why. But then I went and watched it again on Laserdisc and then DVD, and it just didn't. It wasn't, you know, it has its problems. They're there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's a trouble. I could see why it was like, there were no Bond movies for a few years. They claim it was the lawsuit and everything, or MGM wanted Dalton replaced or whatever, but I could see why there were problems. Because it opened the same summer as Lethal Weapon 2 and Batman.
Mm.
Coming out in the theater, and it's like there was no way it was going to do very well.
No.
It doesn't really stack up to...
No.
And I don't think the Lethal Weapon movies are good, but... It doesn't stack up to those in terms of cultural appeal at the time. So what would you give License to Kill, John?
Six.
Stu?
Mm-hmm. I gave it six as well.
Man, it's like the episode six of the Beast. Six, six, six,
six. An Anvil song with an extra six.
Six, 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 six. Yeah, this is an Anvil Bond movie.
There's a band that should have done the Bond song, Anvil.
Anvil, yeah, heck yeah. Didn't they just put out a new record, Anvil?
But they did one in 2020, unless they've done another one.
I think they've, hold on. I'm pretty sure they've got one, a new one.
Holy shit.
How about Ghost? Should Ghost do a Bond movie?
Oh, yes. They could do one very well.
I got to go listen to these guys. Jesus Christ.
John, you got to go listen to Ghost.
This is going to be their ongoing gag. It's like John needs to listen to Ghost.
Impact is imminent 2022 for Anvil.
Fucking Exodus album. Ah, those dummies stole that title.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Impact is imminent is an Exodus album.
From 89 or something. Yeah,
that's the one with the big pinball chasing him.
Yeah. Oh, I'll have to look this one up. Their albums just come and go. They're so hard to find these days.
You just have to be there.
Yeah.
There's an article here I'm reading that executives are so pleased with the dailies of the Munsters that Rob Zombie's going to be directing Bond next.
Yeah, the fact that Eric's not on video, we can see him laughing his ass off. He's actually, you know what? That got me thinking last night when I was at work. I thought if Rob Zombie did a good horror film but not scored it, it could still be a good film. But you know who I'd score that film with, Hunter?
Who?
Carpenter Brute.
Oh, heck yeah. Carpenter Brute is sick.
You ain't kidding. That guy, he is. Why that guy has not scored a horror film yet, like an old John Carpenter, not a John Carpenter, but a John Carpenter-style horror, is I don't think people are cotton on who he is, but shit, this guy is just screaming out to do a horror film.
Yeah.
Even a sci-fi, really.
Have you listened to Leather Terror or whatever the new one is?
No, I just saw it on the Bandcamp last night. There was a new one out.
Yeah, it's pretty epic. It's pretty big. It's, yeah.
That one he did, Leather Teeth, was it about 2 or 3 years back? I like that one a lot.
Mm.
And then the 3 EPs as well before that. But no, Leather Terror, I've just heard a little bit, but it's going to go on the on Bandcamp. I'll give it a spin tonight on there. But
I'm sending John ghost videos.
Yeah, Hunter's bombed my messenger with a bunch of ghost links.
Yeah, check out I sent you the live from the ministry. That one's pretty cool.
Okay.
See next week's episode. John's dressed up as Pop Emeritus.
Yeah.
Yeah. John, take a guess.
Do they change genre with each album?
No, but they have, you know, they're kind
they
of like.
They slowly creep into a new style.
Mm.
They don't do a blatant switch.
It's very gradual. Yes. Actually, Carpenter Brute remixed their song Dance Macabre.
Oh yeah, it's great.
Yeah. But no, they're kind of like, you know, they started out as more Black Sabbath, but they've been slowly morphing into ABBA.
Oh, very interesting.
No, not really. No, it's more melodic hard rock.
But yeah, it's just like it's got a lot of that Swedish pop influence in the heavy in the hard rock stuff, you know.
Mm.
So
like Europe.
Yeah.
It was actually sounds of you know, strains of Europe in this sound. Well, Europe being a Swedish band.
And I think their singer sounds like Buck Dharma from Blue Oyster Cult, you know.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But you know, we did a whole Stu and I did a talk about their new record. Go check that out.
Which is now my favorite Ghost. I listened to it again. It's now my favorite Ghost.
I think it's their best record so far.
Yeah.
The newest one?
The newest one.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Impera.
Yep.
Just has the most, it has more songs that I'll revisit than any other one, I think.
It's the most accessible of their,
yeah,
of their works. I think even more prequel.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't want to start with that then. I want to start with something that you consider lesser. So then I don't, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think what was one to start with would be Meliora, maybe.
Oh yeah, yeah. Meliora is sort of the sort of fork in the road where they,
I mean, I don't think there's any harm in starting at the beginning.
Yeah, you can do, but it's just a big, you listen to them and go, oh, what the hell is Stu and Hunter on about? But if you go to each album. The only thing is, if you go to the second one, it may put you off. It's not great. It's not terrible.
I don't really listen to the second one much.
It's a real sore thumb in a discography where you think, oh, what the hell?
So I'll listen to that last then. How about
that? Yeah. Their first album, though, is, you know, that's the first one I got. And, you know, it caught my attention. So,
yeah. Could probably go with Meliora, like Hunter said, then go to prequel, Impera, then dig.
I got a lot of downtime at work, so I've just been listening to stuff that I probably should have caught up on years ago. And like I'm going through Prince's back catalog. Those first three albums are pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Never heard a Prince album in my life. Never.
Except the Batman.
No, I haven't. Well, I've heard that, but an actual Prince release. No. Never have. Just not my thing. No.
All right, but, guys. I think.
Before we go, name your top three favorite Bond songs.
Ooh, okay.
Ooh,
it's tough. Actually, it's not too tough.
Doesn't have to be in order, just if you want to pick three.
Sure, yeah. I'm not going to do it by which I like the best of the three. I'm just going to spit some out there. All right, let me think. Well, Diamonds Are Forever is up there. It's in the top three.
Is that Shirley Bassey?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Diamonds Are Forever, which I think is the best of the Shirley Bassey, the three of them. Although, I wish I could choose one that they didn't use, because she did one for Quantum of Solace. It depends on who you talk to. Some say it was rejected. Others say it was never in the running at all. But I don't believe the second theory, because bits of the song are used instrumentally in Quantum of Solace. But she made one for Quantum of Solace. It's called No Good About Goodbye, which is a great title for a Bond movie, let alone a song.
What's it called? No Good Jack White.
That's not. Yeah, no, it's not. Yeah, no. I recommend listening to No Good About Goodbye on YouTube, uh-huh. And you tell me. But I'm not going to include it on the top three because it's not in the movie. But Diamonds Are Forever, Thunderball, and not a traditional one, but I'll go with Nobody Does It Better.
Who's that one? Carly Simon?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a fair bit of play on radio over here, that track.
Yeah, it plays on the radio. That and the only two Carly Simon songs you're going to hear on the radio, at least in America, is that one, and you're going to hear the Warren Beatty one, whatever the hell that's called.
Yeah, You're So Vain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, John, what about you?
Nobody Does It Better, Carly Simon. I like the Tom Jones Thunderball tune quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like A View to a Kill, even though it's my least favorite Bond movie.
Great but
I
song. Love that theme. That's a great song. Yeah.
It's fantastic. It's perfect for the I wish it was in a better movie.
Yeah.
Stu, what about you?
All right. I'm going to say From Russia With Love, I really like a lot. Beautiful Kill and Living Daylights by A-ha. I like that song a lot.
So for me, I'm going to say Live and Let Die. Really like that one. I like... which one was that?
The Guns N' Roses version?
No. I like Nobody Does It Better. That's one that always has stayed with me. It's always kind of in my head, in the back of my head somewhere, you know? Like it comes mm-hmm. and goes. And I'm going to say You Know My Name by Chris Cornell. I like that song a lot.
I was going to say, it's one of my least favorites.
I love it. When I heard Chris Cornell was doing a Bond song, I was like, that sounds awful. And I thought it was awesome.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff. You know, I could put A-ha in there. I could put Duran Duran. I could put Diamonds Are Forever. I could put any of the Shirley Bassey ones, you know.
Moonraker have a song or just the score?
It has a song, yeah. It's the least of the Shirley Bassey ones.
Yeah, it's a Shirley Bassey one, you know.
What's it called?
Moonraker.
It's called Moonraker, yeah. The disco one that closes the movie is better, the disco version.
Not as well known as the song for the Ben Affleck film Moonraper.
The Michael Jackson one.
Out of the, Pierce Brosnan, you got Tina Turner. That was a pretty good song. These are
which was written by U2.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah.
So the royalties go to Zelensky.
Eric. Don't care for them.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
I'm going to edit this out.
Every time you watch GoldenEye, the money goes to the Ukraine.
Ukraine, yeah. Not great. I don't know who does Tomorrow Never Dies. I don't even remember that song. Garbage did a pretty good
Crow.
One.
That was Sheryl Crow, yeah.
Garbage does a good one for World's Not Enough. Yep. And then Madonna's is the best one of all, obviously.
Well, Elton John would agree with you.
Yeah.
An underrated one is the one the Pretenders did, or maybe it was just Chrissy Hynde for Living Daylights, which you only hear when that assassin is killing people at the at the safe house.
I thought Blondie did a pretty good one that was rejected for Your Eyes Only.
I haven't heard that.
It's good.
No, I haven't heard it.
Oh.
Yeah, it ended up on their last album before they went on hiatus for like 20 years. Hunter, okay. I think that album is called. It's not a good album, but good song.
Okay, mm-hmm. I got to look for that. After I watched the 30 ghost videos Hunter just sent me.
There you go, yeah.
One that I kind of like that is I think is kind of underrated is All Time High.
Yeah.
All Time High feels like a sequel or sort of, yeah, that's fine. A sequel to Nobody Does It Better in a way. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like All Time High.
I just think it's a nice song. I just like it because you're not going to call your song Octopussy, you know?
Yeah, no. Couldn't get it on the radio.
maybe Prince could do it.
Yeah. Octopussy control, you know?
Yeah. It has a little synthesizer beat to it, you know?
Actually, there's a band who could do a Bond song. What about Nashville Pussy?
Yeah, there you go.
more likely Vanity Six than Nashville Pussy.
Okay. Let me get before we go, what is your least favorite Bond song? Because Stu already revealed his.
Louis Armstrong fucking song.
Oh, Louis Armstrong.
We have all.
The thing about that movie is that it basically has two main themes.
Yes.
And the instrumental's great.
Yeah, it's my favorite Bond theme.
I should have actually put that in. But I guess this is an easy one. Madonna's pretty bad.
It's Madonna. Okay. Yeah. What a
Jack White.
Jack White, that one's pretty awful. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, we're doing top three. Sure. Yeah. Madonna, the Jack White one.
You could do top three worst. I said least favorite, but if you want to go.
Least favorite, yeah.
I'll just say Sheryl Crow, Tomorrow Never Dies.
Sure. Yeah. I don't remember.
That's just because we hate Sheryl Crow, right?
I hate Pierce Brosnan Bond movies anyway, but that theme is terrible.
You know, my least favorite is Man with the Golden Gun by Lulu.
No, because the Alice Cooper one is so much better.
You know that love is required whenever tired. You got top charges, a million a shot. it's just awful.
Yeah, the Alice Cooper band theme is that was rejected is great.
Yeah, and they went with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's on the Muscle of Love album. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I got to hear it.
Golden gun. It sounds like a drunk Ethel Merman wannabe.
The drunk and knees up in somewhere in the UK.
Yeah,
it's not great, but I don't mind it.
Yeah, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, it's bad. Anything's better than that goddamn Madonna song. Holy shit, it's bad.
Dying another day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That film needs to die. It's just so bad.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw it because I'd always heard it was one of the worst. And it starts, and I'm going, okay, you know, it's not very good, but I don't hate it. But then there's a certain point where the movie becomes Batman and Robin, and I just went, it was like Batman and Robin, like Ice Palace and lasers, and
it's like they were unaware the Austin Powers movies had been making fun of them.
It was just tone deaf,
and they just decided to go like as if those movies never happened, which is like once those happen, that's when you kind of scale back and figure out a relaunch.
Yeah,
well, they're married to this idea that every time they reach an anniversary, in that case it was the 40th, they have to do pastiche.
Yeah,
that's a bad idea.
Yeah, because there was like a reference in that to every single Bond movie before it. You know, like you had the Ursula Andress belt. You saw the alligator sub from Octopussy. You know, there were just all these little Easter eggs, but it's, you know.
Unlike these days where Marvel are now requiring kids to watch all 27 films.
Oh, if you want to watch Multiverse of Madness, you have to watch like 50 hours of.
My son did it. I said, what are you doing? Yeah. Oh, I've got to watch this. Oh, I've got to watch. I said, you're a fool. What are you doing?
I got to watch WandaVision and Loki, and
yeah,
I got to
no
watch.
Thanks.
You know,
they also require children to take hormone blockers before they watch the film.
Oh, yeah.
It's
it was ridiculous. He said, oh, I've got another 9 films to go through. I said, you're a fool. I said, you're going to get maybe 2 seconds of information or a 2 second scene that requires you to watch a 2.5 hour movie. I said, this is ridiculous. And you're wasting your young life on these stupid movies. But my 12-year-old didn't watch none of them. He said, I understood the whole thing.
Yeah. You know, it's,
I said, listen, it's your brother.
It's all just Easter eggs. You know, that's it.
It's just a way of the mouse saying, you've got to watch these. So either buy our films or stream them.
Or subscribe to Disney Plus. With that, I think we'll go ahead and say adios.
Yeah, peace out.
Well, good night.
And now it's time for Rue Britannia with your foreign correspondent, the Nez.
In a move that will surprise nobody, avid liberals who still don't want to leave Twitter for Gab, ex-BBC radio rap DJ and black rap music expert Tim Westwood was accused of allegedly assaulting 7 women over the course of a 20-year period at the BBC. The fun part? Westwood is white. The victim's black. Westwood, a controversial figure who for years has adopted a black immigrant community accent, denied the multiple allegations, let alone wanting to be man-out. Quote-unquote, why this, though, is that unacceptable to that bee's knees and past the duchy, he said. Or at least I think he said. Now you're just trying to upset me with that natty gan. Leave it, man. Leave it. He's right. I think I'll leave it. Naturally, the London media went off on a dirty laundry by Don Henley-style charge, more upset about the wrong things as usual rather than the basic allegations. No viewers, no listeners, no ratings. Lovely. Speaking of failure, and after a fortnight on air, Rupert Murdoch's new TV channel, Tool TV, has seen its ratings numbers disappear in a welt of thin air that would impress the late magician Doug Henning, who these days, I would imagine, enjoys healthy ratings making the white light disappear at Haynes. An unhealthy schedule roster of rejects and failures from his own networks, Murdoch's gamble to compete with holding its own GB News has all the success and efficacy of burnt Russian tanks in the Ukraine. Shows headed by Piers Morgan, Sharon Osbourne, language mangler Juliet Harley Brewer, and Mr. Make-Believe himself, James Whale, was always going to basically be a missile heading for Dresden, though with those presences, fewer people probably actually really did die in Dresden. Anyway, why not head over to Piers Morgan's Twitter account and remind him of the time he once wore a Nazi uniform at a party? He'd be disappointed if he didn't. Swimming. And in the battle to stop the boats of illegals crossing the English Channel, the government's new immigration treaty has now, over the course of the last 2 weeks, skewered the media bullseye with tens of thousands of Arab and black immigrants queuing up at Calais and Dover, claiming to be from Ukraine. Under the treaty, in short, a variation of the Australian government's policy of stopping and returning all boats, all illegals who cross the Channel, 4,000 this year alone, will now be formally be repatriated to Rwanda, where presumably bogus ID papers will then render all applications for asylum well and truly goosed. In short, since Home Secretary Priti Patel announced the policy of repatriation, not one single illegal immigrant and one single boat has crossed the Channel in 9 days. Guess who the BBC supported? Further notes in passing, the Conservatives began an internal investigation to allegations that the Tory MP viewed porn and advice in the Commons. Mild for Tory MPs, really, given how a Tory MP was once found dead in January 1984, wearing women's underwear with a plastic bag over his head, clutching a satsuma. A Welsh female Labour MP, anonymous, has accused a member of the party's shadow cabinet of sexist remarks. Namely, somebody accused of, quote-unquote, being a vote winner, and that, quote-unquote, women want to be her friend and men want to sleep with her. An odd statement, to be sure, given how none of Labour's Welsh female MPs can be described as all paintings. East German shopwaters, on the other hand, perhaps. A Catholic police officer wins a case of religious harassment at an industrial tribunal hearing in Glasgow after a colleague scolded the phrase, quote-unquote, fuck the Pope on a Celtic FC mug at work. He should be so blessed if his work colleague actually had left a pack of unopened condoms in his mug. I suspect that the plaintiff would instead have gone off on a killing spree. And the first MP to come out of the closet as a transgender 3 weeks ago got into even more of a right pickle as he, she, it was criminally charged with failing to stop after being involved in the car crash in November last year. Jesse Wallace has also been charged with failing to report a collision, driving without due care and attention, and leaving a vehicle in a dangerous position on a public highway. Women drivers. And finally, Anglo-German relations took a blow this week when former world tennis champion Boris Becker was sentenced to 2.5 years for tax evasion. I know, I'm cheating a bit here to be honest. You know, Boris Becker, Boris Johnson. No mitigation considered a 2 counts for the price of 1 deal. Which is to say, tax evasion plus Boris equals...
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.